an undergrad in Oxford in physics and philosophy, did a PhD in physics at Columbia, and then he went on to do a postdoc at Princeton, and he's now a research associate at Stanford. I also found out today that he has another interesting position, which is he's a scientific advisor to Google X. So it turns out Google X is the branch of Google that works on moonshot-type projects, so particularly crazy ideas. And I guess they needed to find the most creative, bold, and crazy scientists to help them come up with their crazier ideas, and Adam's one of those people. So I think we can all agree that's a great job to have. So Adam works on a number of different topics, in particular early universe cosmology and high energy physics. He's known for being particularly creative and giving very nice talks, so I think we're in for a treat today. So, Adam.
Thank you.
Great. So thank you very much for having me. Today I'm going to be telling you about what is in many ways the most speculative idea I have ever worked on. It is a proposed connection between, on the one hand, complexity, by which I'm going to mean quantum computational complexity, and on the other hand, space-time. And the existence and emergence of space-time. And in particular, I'm going to be telling you about a conjecture that relates these two, called the holographic complexity conjecture. And on the face of it, it seems completely ludicrous that there could be a connection between these two, because on the one hand, the sort of left-hand side and the right-hand side are very different things indeed. In particular, the left-hand side, complexity, is a very quantum property. It is a intrinsically quantum property of a non-gravitational system. More commonly studied in computer science departments than in physics departments. And on the other hand, space-time, but particularly the space-time I'm going to be considering on the right-hand side, is going to be a non, in the limit I'm considering it, a non-quantum properties of a gravitational system. But there's actually an excellent precedent for the idea that there could be connections between very quantum non-gravitational systems and non-quantum gravitational systems. And that precedent is the holographic principle, or more particularly in the form I'm going to be looking at it today, the concrete instantiation of the holographic principle that is ADS-CFD. So in the limit in which we're going to be looking at that today, the CFT side of the ADS-CFT conjecture is a non-gravitational quantum system, and the ADS side, the space-time side, is going to be a gravitational classical system. ADS-CFT is the most important theoretical physics idea of my lifetime. It's this extraordinary connection between a quantum system and a gravitational system in one more dimension, a duality that relates the two of them, that instantiates the holographic principle. And that's the framework in which this conjecture is going to be formulated. But I'll explain that as I go along. So just to remind you, the space-time is going to live in the bulk, in the ADS side of the conjecture. The complexity is going to live on the CFT, the boundary side of the conjecture. And the space-time, or at least the space-times I'm going to be looking at today, are going to be classical space-times, strongly influenced by the gravitational theory. In fact, they're going to be black holes, whereas the complexity is a non-gravitational property of a quantum theory. The final thing that's going to round out this slide is a question mark, because the question mark is meant to instill in you a feeling of sort of unsureness or hesitancy, because this is still very much a conjecture. A conjecture that could very well be wrong. Nevertheless, what I hope to persuade you of today is two things. First of all, I'm going to explain to you what the conjecture is. And secondly, and most importantly, I hope to give you an idea of why we might think this, you know, how you could possibly think that an outlandish conjecture like this could be true. In particular, I will explain to you that it passes a number of non-trivial consistency checks, that seems to provide some evidence that it's worth pursuing. In addition, I should say that as well as being high risk, it is potentially high reward. Because if it does turn out indeed to be correct, this idea, then it's telling us something quite profound, I believe, about the emergence of space-time, about sort of where space-time comes from, as I will elaborate on in a moment. Right, this is an idea that by now has lots and lots of contributors. It started off with a paper by Lenny Susskind in 2014. And on this set of contributors, which is extremely incomplete, I've just been sure to include people who belong to one of two sets. One is my collaborators, and the other is people at Perimeter. In fact, this entire bottom three set here, lines, is entirely people at Perimeter. And I really hope I haven't missed anybody in this room, otherwise that's embarrassing. But Perimeter is, in fact, I'm one of the centers that has been at the forefront of pushing forward this subfield, as is sort of partially exhibited by the sheer numbers, but also by the quality of the people working on it. And I'm therefore particularly flattered to be invited here to talk about it. Okay, let's get going. So the first thing I'm going to do is tell you about the right-hand side, the space-time bit. And the second thing I'm going to do is to tell you about the left-hand side, the complexity bit. And then I will tell you in what way they are related. So first, the space-time bit. The particular space-time that I'm going to be concentrating on is black holes. In fact, it's going to be the wormhole that lies behind the horizon of a black hole, a particular kind of black hole, which is an eternal black hole in ADS. If you don't know what that is, don't worry, I'm just about to tell you. But suffice it to say that this is the very simplest possible non-trivial space-time you can consider in trying to understand holography. And it's just a black hole that is sitting there, that has been there forever, and will be there forever. It's an eternal black hole. And it's in ADS, which means it's in this particular, sitting in this particular space-time that holographers like to consider. And I'm going to remind you, or tell you, dependingly, of one particular geometry fact about this black hole. So this is a picture of the black hole. It's a Penrose diagram. It's a particularly simple way to encapsulate the causal structure of this space-time. And maybe I'll write on the board the metric of this space-time. So this is just the standard Schwarzschild metric, 1 minus 2 gm over r, with this additional ADS term, r squared over l squared. And that's the metric of this ADS black hole. And here's a picture of it. It's a conformal diagram, as shown to us, as taught to us by Penrose. In which time goes up, space goes sideways, and light rays travel at 45 degrees. Since this is a two-dimensional diagram trying to represent a 3 plus 1-dimensional space-time, I have to suppress two of the dimensions. And the two of the dimensions that this diagram suppresses are the spheres, the two-sphere. So the every point on this diagram represents a two-sphere that just wraps the black hole. And so instead, everything's just going to be labeled by the radius, the area radius that you are away from the black hole. That's the space-like coordinate on the x-axis, and what time it is. That's the vertical coordinate. Every point in this diagram represents a two-sphere, but the two-sphere does not have the same size everywhere. In particular, this diagram, this quadrant on the left, you can't quite see the shading with this diagram. This quadrant on the left is going to be the outside of the black hole diagram. And we're going to live, if we're living a long way away from the black hole, out here at that boundary. Whereas the top quadrant is the inside the black hole region. That's what you encounter if you fall into the black hole, that region there. I'll explain the other two quadrants in a moment. And the size of the two-sphere is not the same everywhere. In particular, on this left-hand side, this is the two-sphere that's a really, really long way away from the black hole. It just encompasses the entire black hole. That two-sphere is of infinite size because it's, you know, it's infinitely far away. The beauty of the Penrose diagram is it takes this infinitely far away two-sphere and writes it at a finite point on the board. And then in the future, up here, you have the two-sphere shrinks to zero size, r equals zero, and that's the singularity. That's the point where you get crunched, if you are not already crunched. Right, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to remind you of what the geometry of this looks like by drawing the size of a two-sphere at various different points. So as I said, now this red point here represents a two-sphere, and here it is. It's an infinitely large two-sphere, which I've represented as just a somewhat large two-sphere on the board. And we can trace what happens to the size of that two-sphere if we send in a light ray traveling at 45 degrees on this diagram. And what happens is that the two-sphere starts off infinitely large, and as I trace it in, the size of that two-sphere passes the horizon scale as it crosses the horizon here, which is the diagonal line, and then it hits zero size at the singularity, at the crunch. So the size of a two-sphere is infinitely large on the boundary at r equals infinity, and goes always all the way down to zero size at the singularity. However, that is not the only way to draw a line that goes into the black hole. This is the line that would be followed by a light ray that was falling into the black hole, but it is possible to draw a line that goes into the black hole horizontally rather than at 45 degrees. Now, I want to stress that it is not possible to follow a line if you're a space traveler that goes horizontally. However, because that involves traveling faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light says that you can only travel vertically or at most at 45 degrees to the vertical and no more on this diagram. But it is possible to just draw a space-like line that cannot be traveled by any, cannot be followed by any space-like, by any time-like observer, and just see what happens to the size of the black hole. And the first people to do this investigation, Kruskal and others, were extremely surprised by what they found. And what they found was the following, is that if you follow a space-like line that goes through the black hole, then just as before, the size of the black hole of this two-sphere that corresponds to each point gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller until reaching a minimum at the horizon, and then it expands out again into the through the wormhole region of the black hole, into the other side, an entire other side that lives out there at r equals infinity in this mathematically idealized version of a black hole. You cannot, however, reach the other side. You cannot traverse the wormhole, because to do so, you'd have to travel faster than the speed of light. But we can certainly ask, what would happen if a space-like line was drawn across there? And this is what a cross-section looks like. Okay, so let's see that again. It gets smaller and smaller and smaller through the wormhole, and then gets larger and larger and larger again on the other side, symmetrically going back to infinite size. So this is a geometry fact about ADS. A geometry fact about any eternal black hole. The ADS part is, in fact, not playing an important role in the story. Okay, in fact, the size of the wormhole, well, it starts off infinitely large on either side, but in the middle here, it has its horizon size. It's the smallest it ever gets to. There's a time that runs on both r equals infinity. So you could imagine some time is running up, some time on the left, and some time on the right. The vertical direction in this diagram is time. And you can ask, what is the profile, the cross-section, by connecting any two points on either side, on either r equals infinity boundary, any two times on r equals infinity boundary, with a line that connects them. I just drew the line for when it's t left and t right are both equal to zero, when they're both anchored in the middle, but you could imagine pushing either one up or down on either side and re-asking this question, asking what does the cross-section look like that connects the two on either side. One fact is that this space-time has a symmetry that means if you push the time up on the left and down on the right, or vice versa, that in fact nothing happens to the cross-section. That's a complete symmetry of this space-time. However, there's a different question you could ask, which is suppose that I take the time on the left and on the right and push them up, or equivalently just hold the time fixed on one side and push the time up on the other side. What does a cross-section through that space-time look like? And if you choose some covariant way to connect them, some way to connect the two sides that respect the symmetries of the problem, what you will find is this. What you will find is that the outside, the horizon region, the region out in the left quadrant and the right quadrant, doesn't change very much. But the region inside, well, it goes from being there not being really anything there at all to, as you pull the two sides up, there's more and more and more of this surface that lives inside the behind the horizon region, inside the wormhole. The size of it changes a little bit, but actually, if you calculate it, the width, I should say, doesn't change very much at all, but the length does. The length grows, and it grows linearly with time. In fact, it's easy to show that the length of the wormhole grows linearly with time. And so that's, in fact, the number one geometry fact that you need to know about black holes for this talk, is that the length of a wormhole that lives behind the horizon of a black hole grows linearly with the boundary time.
Sorry, question. Is the red line a maximal surface here, or is it, how do you decide what red line is?
Yeah, I just said that we're going to draw it in a covariant prescription. You can imagine that it's a maximal surface. So it is the higher dimensional generalization of a space-like geodesic that is a surface of maximal 3 volume. But in fact, I'm going to tell you another way to characterize the size of the wormhole. It actually doesn't matter that much how you characterize the size of the wormhole. This is a very robust property that the length of the wormhole grows linearly with time. Okay, so that is the geometry part. That's the space-time part. And the takeaway is just this single takeaway, that the length of a wormhole grows linearly with time. Now let's do the quantum part. So what does the holographic principle, ADS-CFT, tell us? What the holographic principle tells us is that the classical geometry that lives within a black hole, that lives within this entire space-time, is equivalent to a strongly quantum theory that lives on the surface of this space-time, that lives on the boundary of this space-time. In other words, lives out at r equals infinity. And that's the particular quantum theory is a conformal field theory, a CFT, but it's a strongly quantum field theory that lives on the boundary. In fact, here there are two boundaries. If there wasn't the black hole, there would just be a single boundary. But because of the eternal black hole that's living in this space-time, there are two r equals infinity regions, one on the left boundary and one on the right boundary. And the corresponding conformal field theory that corresponds to this one higher dimensional gravity theory. So notice that the CFT doesn't extend in the space-like direction here. It only has the spherical direction, which is why it's living in one fewer dimension than the gravity theory. The CFT lives on both sides, on both boundaries. In fact, this is the sort of simplest possible example, non-trivial example of holography you can think of. It is well known what the quantum state is that corresponds to the eternal black hole, that is dual to the eternal black hole, that lives on the boundary of the eternal black hole. This is called the thermofield double state, and this is the state when written in terms of the energy eigenstates on the left and the right boundary. So EI is the energy eigenstate on the right boundary, left is the energy eigenstate on the left boundary, and the quantum state that corresponds to this bulk geometry is given by this expression. It is a pure state, on both boundaries. It is a pure state overall. Nevertheless, if you're living on the right boundary and you don't know about the left boundary, you need to trace out the left states, or vice versa. If you just lived on the left boundary and didn't know about the right boundary, you trace that out, and then it wouldn't look like a pure state. Then it would look like a mixed state. In fact, it would look like a very specific mixed state. It would look like a thermal mixed state with a temperature. And indeed, in this correspondence, the temperature of the state would be the Hawking temperature of the corresponding black hole, and the entanglement entropy between the left and the right CFTs is given by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. That's an important consistency check, which the ADS-CFT conjecture passes. Okay, that's what the state looks like at one time, at say T left and T right equal to zero. What does the state look like at some other time? Well, since we wrote it in the energy eigenbasis, it's very simple to evolve what the state looks like. You just evolve it according to the phase advance of each energy eigenstate. And so this is the quantum state that corresponds to a given anchor time left on the left and right on the right. And what the ADS-CFT conjecture tells us is that every property of, it tells you that there is an equivalence between these two theories, that the boundary CFT theory is exactly equivalent to the bulk ADS theory, and in particular that every property of one has a corresponding property of the other, and vice versa. So the question that you can ask is, you know this geometry fact. You know that the length of a wormhole grows linearly with time. That's a fact that pertains to the black hole side, the ADS side of the conjecture. What is the boundary jewel of that fact? What is the property of the CFT that is growing linearly in time that corresponds to the length of the wormhole? Now, what the holographic principle promises you is that there is a property of one that corresponds to the other. It certainly does not promise you that there is a simple property of the bulk that of the boundary that corresponds to this property of the bulk. And indeed, the conjecture is not that it is a simple property. The conjecture is, in some sense, that it is the least simple property possible. The conjecture is that the property of the CFT that corresponds to the linear growth of the wormhole is the complexity itself. Okay. And so now I'm just going to tell you what I mean by complexity. In particular, the version of complexity that I mean is the computational complexity of the quantum state, the gate-counting computational complexity of the quantum state. So for example, the quantum state that we might be interested in is the state that lives on the boundary that I told you had that form. And the question is, what is the computational complexity? And so I'll give you the definition now. But before I give you the definition, I will first sort of explain what the intuitive idea behind complexity is. Consider the following two states. The state on the left is the Earth as it exists exactly at this moment with all the people and everything else that it contains. Plus a single electron floating somewhere off in space that is in the spin-up state. Now consider this other state, the right state. The right state is the Earth as it existed 5 seconds ago, whenever I said it, plus a single electron floating off somewhere in space that is in the spin-down state. And now I'm going to ask you a question, and the question is, are these two states close to each other? Are they nearby states, or are they far states? Now, we have a good definition of the proximity of two states, and that is the inner product distance. You take two states, you calculate their inner product. If it's one, they are the same state. If it's zero, they are orthogonal, so they're completely different states. And so you can do that. You can use that notion of proximity, the inner product distance, on these two states. And it's clear that if you do that, the answer will be these two states are orthogonal. Why? Well, the Earth bit, with all of its trillions and trillions of degrees of freedom, are in exactly the same state. They are indeed. But the electron, well, a spin-up electron is orthogonal, has a zero inner product with a spin-down electron. Therefore, these two states are orthogonal to one another. According to the inner product distance, they are as far apart as any two states can possibly be. It is impossible to find two quantum states that are more distant from each other than these two quantum states are from each other. Nevertheless, we have an intuitive notion of proximity in which these two states are a good deal closer to each other than just a generic state where you just scramble the state of the Earth would be from that, even if those two states had a small but non-zero inner product. In other words, there is a notion, why do we think these two states are close to each other? We think they're close to each other because you only need to change one thing to get from here to here. You just need to go in and you act with a single NOT gate, a single flip gate on the down, and then you get to the up. You get to the exact same state. And so what this is telling you is that there is a notion of proximity on Hilbert space that the inner product metric is not capturing. That notion of proximity is the question, how easy is it to get from one state to another state? How many gates do you need to apply to get, not gates in this case, to get from one state to another state? And that is the notion of proximity that complexity, quantum computational gate complexity, is meant to be capturing. The sense in which these two states are close to each other. And so the question that quantum computational gate complexity, and so once we develop this definition, we'll see that according to that definition of proximity, these two states are quite close to each other. So here it is. It says the proximity of two states is starting in the first state, how many fundamental gates do you need to apply if you're building a quantum circuit of some kind? For example, how many unit trees each of which act on only one or two of the qubits at a time and not all of the qubits at once, otherwise you could get anywhere in a single step. How many fundamental gates do you need to act on the first state, the reference state, to reach the target state of interest? And then as a technical matter, we'll often need to put some notion of tolerance so that we declare victory if we get sufficiently close to the target state, even if we don't exactly hit it. Okay, so that's the definition of complexity that I'm going to be considering in this talk.
Sorry, this is proximity, but what is complexity?
Complexity is a number. It asks this question. It says, how many fundamental gates do you need? So it's going to be some counting number.
Or two states. Do you define complexity for two states
then? It is a relational property of states. So it is going to be starting in some reference state or some state that you're interested in. How many gates you need to reach some other state.
Can I ask at this point? So
go ahead.
I think I understand this for qubits, but how do you go from qubits to a quantum field qubit?
Great. So that is that's an excellent question. You're going to have to, this particular definition I've given here makes reference to qubits and gates, so it's kind of more useful definition for someone who's actually building a quantum computer than it might be for the continuum evolution of a quantum field theory. And in fact, there are sort of superior definitions of complexity that we and a number of other people are working on, including people here at Perimeter, trying to adapt this sort of discrete gate definition of complexity to a more continuum version like a quantum field theory. But roughly how it works is that the same way that it always works trying to get a quantum field theory is the continuum limit of any discrete process. So you break it up into discrete, you discretize it. Okay, I'm just going to give you a very simple example. In fact, even simpler example than the quantum computational complexity of a quantum state is the computational complexity of a classical state. In fact, this is almost laughably simple, but you are not allowed to laugh. So you could ask the same question here, starting in a reference state. So since it's classical, it's now not a whole bunch of qubits, it's just a whole bunch of bits. And so we can imagine that we start off, say, in the all zero states, where all of the n bits are all zero. It says, how many fundamental gates do you need to make a target state? And so, in fact, for classical state complexity, the NOT gate is universal for this extremely simple version of complexity. And so you can imagine building a circuit by laying out a whole bunch of NOT gates that map ones to zeros and zeros to ones, and asking how many NOT gates do I need to reach the target state starting in the initial state. And so what would be the answer for this target state?
3.
Great, that is the right answer. So you need 3 NOT gates to start off in the reference state and make the target state. This is just meant to be sort of preparing your mind for the quantum. And how about now?
6.
Yeah, so it's actually a trick question. There are 6 NOT gates that are used to make the target state from the reference state. So the complexity of this can be no bigger than 6, but actually it is not equal to 6. It's actually equal to 4. And the reason is it's not asking how many gates did you use to make the target state. It's asking how many gates did you need to use to make the target state. And in this case, the answer is simply 4. In fact, this is a completely solved problem. If you're thinking of doing your PhD in the complexity of classical states defined in this way, I would advise you not to, because the answer is the complexity is just given by the number of ones on the right-hand side. Okay, but however, the quantum case is much more interesting, but nevertheless follows pretty much the same pattern. And the quantum case, now single qubit gates are not universal even for state complexity. They in fact fail to generate any entanglement between the various qubits, so you need 2 qubit states. But it turns out that 2 qubit gates are universal for quantum state complexity, and so you just build up the circuit in this way and ask how many gates do you need to hit the target state. Since you're laying down a discrete number of gates, and there's an uncountable number of states in the Hilbert space, you may need to give yourself some tolerance. But other than that, it works much the same as it did for classical complexity, with one big difference. And the one big difference, the essential difference, is going to be in the sort of capacity of these states to, is going to be in the maximal complexity of these states, which we'll see is going to be much larger for quantum states than it was for classical states defined in this way. Okay, and we're going to see that by calculating the evolution of the complexity. So if you have, let's again first do the classical n bits, and now let's imagine we're going to make a random circuit, and the way we're going to make a random circuit is just by throwing down gates at random, not gates at random. The total number of classical states you can have on n bits is 2 to the n. Each one can take one of 2 values. And so that means that the maximum possible complexity of a n-bit classical state is just n. And in fact, if you build up a circuit by just sort of randomly throwing down gates, at the beginning, it's highly unlikely that you'll hit a 1. You know, if the rule is, if you hit something that was previously a 0, the complexity goes up by 1 when you throw down a NOT gate. If you hit something that was previously a 1, the complexity goes down by 1, and because it goes back down to 0 again. When you first start off, the complexity will grow linearly with time, with the number of gates. And it'll keep growing linearly with time until you get to of order n gates, over 2 gates. And then it'll max out at n over 2. This isn't a very large n limit. If n is not all that large, then there will be some fluctuations. There will be some fluctuations. If n is not that large, the fluctuations will be large. But in the limit where n is very large, it'll approximately just follow this path. So this is just I'm building up a circuit by just throwing down gates at random. Now we can ask the same question of n qubits. And what we'll find is that the capacity for n qubits to be complex is ginormously larger than the capacity of n bits. But you don't have to take my word for it, because I'm not sure whether the sound is going to work, but we'll see. If not, you'll just have to read along in the subtitles.
What quantum states allow for is much more complex information to be encoded into a single bit. Regular computer bit is either a 1 or a 0, on or off. A quantum state can be much more complex than that.
Okay, he basically nailed it. You can somehow assign whatever confidence you like to a combination of him and me. Okay, and so what is the story? The story is now that the bits do not have to be either 0 or 1, as Justin said. They can be any combination of zeros and ones. In fact, there's now 2 to the n coefficients to specify when you're writing down the wave function of n qubits. And now you can ask the following question. You can ask, if you have a n-qubit state on an n-qubit Hilbert space, what is the number of exactly orthogonal states? Number of states, every single one of which in this set is orthogonal to every other state. Well, the answer to that question is still 2 to the n. In fact, it's no larger than it was classically. Like, it's not only is it no larger than it was classically, it is exactly the 2 to the n classical states. There's just one for every basis vector in the Hilbert space, and you're more than free just to take the classical basis, the unentangled basis, in the Hilbert space. However, there's a closely related question that has a very different answer. The closely related question is no longer what's the largest set so that every element in that set is exactly orthogonal to every other state. The question is, what is the largest set so that every element is almost orthogonal to every other state? In fact, you don't even, this would be true even if we went for almost orthogonal, but we could even say, you know, orthogonal up to just 1% or 99%. It doesn't matter. I mean, it'll affect those twos, and they might become other things. But the crucial behavior is that it now grows doubly exponentially in n, not singly exponential in n. I mean, that's precisely the sort of larger possibility state space that we just heard about. And so here's a sort of plausibility argument. This doesn't actually prove it, but here's a plausibility argument for this conclusion. Just consider this subset of the quantum states that are sort of on the diagonal, in the sense that the coefficient in front of every, the normalized coefficient in front of every one of the 2 to the n basis vectors is either plus or minus 1. It's clear, first of all, that there are doubly exponentially many of those, since you've now got 2 to the n binary choices to make. And it's clear that almost all of those are almost orthogonal to almost all of the others. And so that provides an almost example of this fact. There's actually a few in here that are not almost orthogonal to each other, but you can successfully prune those indeed show that that is correct, this double exponential scaling with n. This is sometimes known as the fact that Hilbert space is huge. Okay. Whereas the number of circuits you can build, say out of 2-qubit gates, gates that only touch 2 qubits at once, well, each time I lay down a gate, I had n squared possibilities of which 2 qubits I was going to connect. And so the number of circuits certainly can't grow any faster than n squared to the number of gates. In other words, it can't grow any faster than exponentially in the number of gates. So if I want to fill up this double exponential Hilbert space with epsilon balls that are close to any given target state in it, the maximum complexity must be exponentially large in n. And so this is, in fact, the whole point of this discussion is this fact. The maximum complexity of a quantum state is exponentially large in the number of qubits in it, whereas the maximum complexity of a classical state, defined that way, is only polynomially large, like linearly large in n. But with that one exception, everything else looks much as it did before. In fact, I keep throwing down quantum gates, and I'm very unlikely to make something that there could have been a shortcut. That, you know, could there have been a shortcut like we have with the 2 NOT gates that made that circuit faster? Well, that's very unlikely to happen for a small number of gates. In fact, it'll just generically grow linearly with time if I just keep throwing down gates at random. Until the complexity gets near maximal, until the complexity gets exponentially large. And then once it's exponentially large, then there are likely, just on counting grounds, to have been shortcuts. And so the complexity maxes out at about 2 to the n. And sure, I can make a bigger and bigger circuit by making a super exponential circuit that makes it, but there'll be some smaller circuit that approximates the same thing which is only 2 to the n large. Okay, so that's the definition of complexity. And this provides, so now to state the conjecture in its in a slightly less precise form. The conjecture is that these two things are the same. That somehow the linear size of the wormhole and the linear growth of the size of the wormhole is related to the linear growth of complexity. In fact, the conjecture is going to be that, roughly speaking, the computational complexity of the boundary state characterizes the length of the wormhole that lives in the bulk, and vice versa. And here we've seen our first two pieces of evidence that that's so. The first piece of evidence is that they are both expected to grow linearly at early times. The complexity grows linearly because you're highly unlikely to get a collision early on, where there's some shortcut circuit that would make it faster. The wormhole grows linearly. That's just a geometry fact that we saw at the start of this discussion. The second piece of evidence is somewhat more impressive. It says that not only do they start off growing linearly, but they continue to grow linearly for an exponential time. And that's impressive. And the reason that's impressive is that if you look at any property of the boundary, of the quantum state that lives on the boundary, any sort of non-fine-grained quantity, it would expect it to saturate. It would expect it to max out at time that's just polynomial in the number of qubits there are. You'd have a system that would thermalize anything you do to it. There'll be some transient behavior while the gas expands from the corner of the box or whatever it's going to do. But in a polynomial time, you'd expect it to thermalize. And in fact, it's impossible to find a non-fine-grained quantity that does not thermalize, that continues to grow linearly for a exponential time. And so that's why complexity has to be a quantity like complexity and unlike any more natural quantities one might write down on the boundary state that has this capability to keep growing linearly for a exponentially long time. And so it has to be a fine-grained quantity like complexity.
I guess there are two things I'm confused about. One is, I guess complexity is relating two different states to each other. So what are the two states that you're relating? At least that's the way you define it. So,
I'm going to... So for the time being, I'm just about to give a slightly more precise definition of complexity. You can imagine that it's relating the complexity of whatever state you have to the complexity of the thermal field doubles, the T equals zero state.
You're thinking about
there is more to say about that question. But as a working definition, you can take that as the working definition.
Okay. Other thing is that you said it grows linearly. So what is it that you take the log of that number and you say it grows linearly? Is that what you define as complexity?
No, there's no logarithm in there. So the definition of complexity is the number of gates you need to make the circuit.
I see.
So to make the state.
Okay.
So that's the thing that grows linearly.
The analog of the number of gates is the number of time steps.
Yeah, that's right. So you're imagining, actually it's not a random circuit that we're building it. We're building it by applying a Hamiltonian on the boundary. And so you can consider some discretized version of that to be building a random circuit, right? So there's the time is related to the number of gates. Okay, so here's a just slightly more precise attempt to characterize what we mean by the size of the wormhole, which is the following. This is just the rule. And the rule is, rather than just constructing some line that passes from the left to the right, the preferred thing to do is to construct this shape that I've just written down here. So by sending in light rays forward and backwards from the boundary, construct the shaded region that's not very shaded on this board here, this internal region here, and then calculate the action of that, the Einstein-Hilbert, everything else in your theory action, and divide by h bar. And it turns out, and then the conjecture is that the complexity is in fact related to that. There are various technical reasons I won't go into why action may be preferred as a calculator of the length of the wormhole. And indeed, it has the property that just like the length of the wormhole itself, it characterizes the size of the wormhole well. It grows linearly with time with the size of the wormhole. Right. And then there were two things I was going to tell you about. One is an attempt to... that basically what I just described is the conjecture. I was going to tell you two more things about this conjecture, which are, first of all, an attempt to get this prefactor here, so that it's not just a tilde, but that there's actually an equal sign there. And the second thing I want to do is tell you a sort of stronger, non-trivial piece of evidence that this conjecture is true. Before, I just showed you sort of two pieces of evidence, one of which is that it grows linearly, and the other of which is that it continues to grow linearly for an exponential time. There are actually much more sort of precise calculations that will where you perturb the system, and you see that the perturbation is the same on either side. So those are the two things I'm going to tell you for the rest of this talk. Are there any questions before I do that?
You said the complexity saturates.
Right.
Is there an analog of that in terms of the length of the wormhole or this action for each bar? Is there a saturation?
Yeah. So the thing that the semi-classical description on the bulk side tells you is that nothing goes wrong before you reach that timescale, or at least we know of nothing that could make it go wrong before it reached that timescale. What exactly is the thing on the bulk side that goes wrong at that timescale is not really clear. That's the timescale that's characteristic of Hawking page transitions in the ADS time, so that's probably what ends up being related to this exponential timescale, but we don't have a precise connection between the two of them. We just know that both of them are sort of good up to an exponential time. And then they both broke down for their own reasons, but trying to sort of exactly relate the two breakdowns is not something that anyone has managed to do so far. Maybe I'll go through, I'll just mention very briefly this how to fix the constant proportionality, which may now go a bit fast. The way to do this, that we have tried to do this with, is by looking at bounds on the rate of complexification. So, in fact, bounds that emerge just from quantum mechanics and not from quantum gravity considerations, but purely from quantum mechanical considerations, on what is the fastest rate at which any system can complexify. You may know about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle that says that delta x delta p is bigger than h bar over 2. You may also have heard about the energy time uncertainty principle, and if you are a real expert, you know that it's complete nonsense. And the reason that there can't be something that is exactly this form, relating the uncertainty in energy to the uncertainty in time, that has exactly the same form as the XP uncertainty relationship, is that X is an operator in quantum mechanics, but T is not. In the standard formulation of quantum mechanics, T isn't an operator, it's just a parameter. So it's not even clear at all what a statement like this would mean, an energy time uncertainty relationship like that would mean. Nevertheless, there are people who are sort of creative and come up with different definitions that sort of are reminiscent of this, or to sort of attempt to give meaning to this, that's not just the sort of standard definition that you would import from the energy momentum, the space momentum uncertainty relation. And one of those is a theorem about how rapidly one state can evolve and evolve to an orthogonal state. So if you start off with some state at time zero and ask, how rapidly can that state evolve to another state that is orthogonal to the first state? Well, there's a theorem about this. First of all, consider the following. Suppose you just have a two-state system like this, one of which is energy zero, the other of which is energy delta, and we consider, as here, an equal superposition of those two states. Now, if you evolve that time according to the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, you'll find that after time t, the zero state's just the same, but the excited state has picked up a phase. In other words, the inner product of the original state with the evolved state is given by this expression here, which means that after you have waited a time inversely proportional to the gap between the two states, the energy of the two states in the superposition, the state will be orthogonal to its initial state. Phi of t will be orthogonal to psi of 0. In fact, you can be more precise. It'll be exactly this, pi h bar over 2 times the expected value of the energy above the energy of the ground state. And it turns out that this is tight. There's in fact a theorem, the last actual theorem that will appear in what I'm about to tell you, that the most rapid way that one state can evolve that a state can evolve to another state orthogonal to itself, that must take an amount of time that scales inversely with the expected energy of the state above the ground state. That is a theorem, and that's a sort of one version of a energy time uncertainty relationship, talking about the length of time it takes to evolve in terms of the expected value of the energy. Right, that's the theorem. Now there's a conjecture, and the conjecture is used by Seth Lloyd, and it says, well, if you take a state and it takes a certain length of time to evolve to an orthogonal state, you can ask how many operations can you perform per unit time that take you, in other words, how many gates can you apply, perhaps, per unit time? It must take at least this length of time to implement a NOT gate. Why? Because a NOT gate takes you from a state to another orthogonal state. And so the conjecture is that the number of operations you can perform in any given time, in other words, the rate of increase of complexity, is upper bounded by the energy. That the rate of complexification is upper bounded by the energy, the expected energy of the state. I'll tell you that this is somewhat controversial because there are models of computation in which you don't have to go through a sequence of orthogonal states, that you can somehow sort of do all of the gates in parallel to one another. There are models of computation in which you appear to be able to beat this. So it's there is still some debate in the computer science literature about whether this is true, or rather, for what definition of complexity this is true and for what definition it isn't true. This bound, however, if we just take it at face value, is a very rapid bound indeed. It tells you how fast computers can be and the rapidity with which computers can operate as a function of their energy. And it's a very fast bound. So for example, if you take a CPU that weighs 100 grams, well, a modern CPU that weighs 100 grams operates at about 10 to the 12 floating point operations per second, whereas the bound implied by this is that for a 100 grams worth of matter, you can actually do 10 to the 50 floating point operations per second. So we still have some way to go before we're anywhere near saturating this bound.
Sorry, what energy are you talking about here?
Here, in this particular example, so here the definition is the expected energy of the state above its ground state, or above the minimal excited state. So for example, if you had an energy eigenstate, it couldn't compute at all. You need some spread of energy in order to be able to compute. So here I just put 100 grams in, mc squared, and that gives you the bound on the rate of computation.
But of course, that's not fair. I mean, you want to have like atomic energy levels or something.
That's right. So why is it failing to saturate this bound? And the answer is that modern CPUs are incredibly wasteful. They lock up almost all of the energy in the sort of rest mass energy of the carbon atoms that constitute them. So this is somehow if you could unlock all of that energy all at once. It's clear that if you did want to unlock all of that sort of computational capacity all at once, you shouldn't use anything based on carbon, because carbon is, atoms are very wasteful. They have a huge amount of rest mass energy that ruins it. The conjecture is, in fact, that you shouldn't use atoms at all, that you should use black holes. And this is sort of consistent with a whole bunch of other conjectures and theories that we have about how black holes perform at computing tasks and information processing tasks. So there's a famous conjecture that a black hole, due to Hawking, that a black hole is the most efficient hard drive one could possibly imagine, if your scarce resource is energy, or your scarce resource is energy and space, that they are the densest possible hard drives. There's also other evidence from the fast scrambling conjecture that black holes process information as rapidly as possible, that they scramble information that falls into them as rapidly as it's possible to scramble information. And maybe I will just say that if you assume that, first of all, that this conjecture is correct for our definition of complexity, and secondly, that black holes saturate these limits on how rapidly things can compute, then what you find is that you can fix this this order one prefactor here, and you can fix it into this rather handsome formula here. In other words, when the action advances by pi, e to the i action goes from 1 to minus 1, the complexity increments by 1. I will say that this, both from the boundary side and the bulk side, this conjecture bound on computation is under study and on studies, including by people here at Perimeter. But that is the boldest form of the conjecture. Okay, since I'm out of time, I will not tell you, except in passing, that there's additional evidence that arises by not taking a pure black hole that just sits there entirely unperturbed, but instead by sort of perturbing it, just by coming in and just sort of tapping the system. And what you find when you do that is that there are two things that happen. There's one that happens in the bulk and one that happens on the boundary. In the quantum theory, there's a sort of chaotic growth of this perturbation as it grows under Lyapunov growth and just grows exponentially fast. That turns out, so you have some expectation about what that should be, how it should affect the complexity. And that exponential growth of complexity that you get under the impact of a perturbation exactly matches a gravitational exponential growth. And the gravitational exponential growth is that a perturbation that starts off very small near the boundary, as it falls into the gravitational field of the ADS and into the gravitational field of the black hole, it grows stronger and stronger and stronger. It gets exponentially gravitationally blue shifted. And you can calculate how much exponential growth you get on either side. And they exactly match. They sort of match rather better than you might initially imagine they should. And so that's just the effect, the sort of gravitational effect of this sort of initial tap that just turns into a huge shockwave as it falls into the black hole. Okay, that's it. Other bits of perturbation, other bits of evidence that you can come up with. But I guess I will round up by saying that if this is true, this conjecture seems quite exciting. And the reason that it's quite exciting is that it, in some sense, tells us what space-time is made of. There are, in fact, other pieces of evidence that I have not gone into at all for how you can perhaps think of the sort of construction of space-time as being like a quantum circuit. And the complexity equals action, the holographic complexity conjecture, shows you what space-time is made of, and sort of this idea that space-time itself at the quantum gravitational level is made of gates. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
We start with questions from the
students. So here you are drawing a correspondence between wormholes and complexity. But how does complexity relate to CFD? Because that's the quantum part of this course.
Right. Yeah, so the idea is that there's the ADS-CFT conjecture, which is this the framework for all of this. It's the holographic conjecture. And so this is the classical gravity bit. This is the bit that has the wormhole in it. That's growing linearly with time. And the CFT bit is the quantum system. So it doesn't really make sense to ask what is the complexity of the classical, what is the quantum complexity of this classical system? Instead, you're asking, what is the quantum complexity of the CFT? That's the state that lives on the boundary. So this is the boundary state. That's the sort of highly quantum state. And this is the state whose complexity you're interested in. Does that answer your question? So this, you are considering the complexity of the boundary state, the quantum state that lives on the boundary of this space-time. And that is the thing that is meant to be dual to the linear growth, the geometrical factor, the linear growth of the wormhole.
So the gates that you'd be applying onto the CFT, those are like gates acting on the Hilbert space of like the field theory. Are they like local gates, or are they just what do they look like exactly, I suppose?
Great. So that's a good question, which is coming back to the question that was asked earlier on, which is the relationship between this vocabulary of gates that I've been using and discrete gates that apply, and how that works for a continuum CFT. Roughly speaking, well, there's sort of two levels at which I can answer that. The first level is that these gates would not have to be local in the CFT. They would be sort of bilocal in the CFT. So just like a gate can touch any two qubits in the system, these gates could touch at most two places in the CFT and not more than two places in the CFT. However, eventually you'd like to move, just use this as a scaffolding, this notion of a gate complexity, and move to a fully continuum version of a fully continuum notion of complexity in which the sort of gate that reduces to the gate definition in one limit but is better adapted to a continuum system. And so I've been thinking somewhat along those lines. There was a former perimeter faculty member, Michael Nielsen, had a beautiful set of ideas about how you could have a fully continuum definition of complexity that didn't involve gates at all. There's also been other people in the last couple of years at perimeter who've invented other notions of complexity that are more appropriate to the field theories. So just to sort of, the short answer to your question is that there's the gates, insofar as you can think of them as a gate description, have to be bilocal. They have to touch only two qubits at a time, not all the qubits. Because if you just go and allow yourself to touch all the qubits at once, then you can get anywhere in a single step. And we would prefer to come up with a definition of complexity that just threw away the whole gate thing entirely and came up with a better definition of complexity that I haven't spoken about at all today. But still sort of, as its fundamental core, is trying to capture how hard or easy a certain transformation is trying to do. This sort of thing with the two Earths, plus a spin up and a spin down, that's really what we want out of the notion of complexity, is capturing notions of easiness and hardness.
Yeah. So in the eternal black hole, like sort of general scenario, we have this partition into the boundary as being two separate CFTs in some sense. And of course, like the reference state is a state across both, but the complexity that's being measured is with respect to the number of gates. And my question is about, are those gates acting in across the CFTs, or like are you talking about manipulating two points just on the right or on the left? And what's the difference in complexity in that way?
So in the examples that I gave, the time evolution operator is local on both sides of the CFT. So that means that to evolve the left CFT in time, I don't need to act on the right CFT. I can just act with gates that only hit the left. And that reflects something about the physical world, which is that it's local. Or, you know, we don't actually live in ADS CFT, but that you could, if you were just sitting on the left boundary, you could notice what was going on just by looking at the left CFT.
Okay.
What would happen if you consider a non-eternal black hole?
So something that I should stress is that this conjecture, if it's going to be any good, cannot merely apply to unperturbed eternal black holes that don't do anything. This conjecture is meant to be a full holographic conjecture that applies in every possible state you could put, or at least every holographic state that you could put on this space-time. So I skipped over at the end one way in which you could perturb it, which would be just to take an eternal black hole and break the time translation symmetry by sending in a small perturbation at one time. And I briefly mentioned what happens under those circumstances. But you could imagine a much more dramatic perturbation, that in fact there wasn't even a through the timehole region, the wormhole region. So these wormholes only exist for eternal black holes, which is just some particularly nice mathematical solution of general relativity. But you could imagine instead that we live in a space-time that has no black hole whatsoever, and that we then make a black hole in the manner that supernovae make black holes, which is by collapsing regular matter. So in fact, in the simplest case, you could just take in a null shell. Start with no black hole, take some matter, a null shell that goes in and forms a black hole at some time. And that would be a one-sided black hole, and it works in that case too. So that would be a very important consistency check that I didn't mention but has been done, which is if you make a black hole in the manner that I just described, by taking matter and collapsing it into a form of black hole, you correctly reflect, one, that there's no complexification that happens before the black hole is formed, that the system is just sitting there not really doing anything, and that once you make a black hole, it then starts complexifying linearly with time.
The comment and the question. The comment is that the idea that the geometry of space-time is made from entanglement is a very old idea. It goes back at least to Roger Penrose's notes about spin networks in the early 1960s. So it's a theme which keeps coming back. And this version is very interesting. But the question is, in the ABS-CFT kind of examples, we generate one dimension of space. And we're used to thinking about that as that extra dimension is a scale and is related to an idea of the renormalization group and implementing the renormalization group as time evolution. But when you just write something like complexity of space-time or entanglement generates space-time, you have in mind something going beyond just generating one dimension from something analogous to a holographic renormalization group. So I wonder if you can tell us how we get the other directions, the other dimensions.
Okay, let me first address the bit before the but in your question, which is that this is an old idea. Indeed, this is an old idea, and it's also extremely... I sort of didn't do justice here to the sort of environment in which this conjecture lives, which is a great sort of resurgence in interest in these ideas about entanglement and black holes, in fact, and the emergence of space-time. In fact, there is a... sort of holography sort of cast that into a sort of new and more exciting light, and there is a whole bunch of work more precisely relating entanglement to the existence of black holes. The famous Rutaganagi conjecture, for example, of 2006, that would be a sort of model framework for what this conjecture would end up looking like, which is that that very precisely relates a information theoretic property of the boundary, namely the entanglement entropy of some precisely defined region, to a geometric property of the bulk, namely in that case, the volume of some maximal surface hanging down into the bulk. And that's an extremely precise idea by now that has a great deal of empirical checks, or theoretical checks, I should say, that have been done on it. And so this is a very, this sort of idea of relating quantum information properties of the boundary to ideas of the bulk is one that has a great history. This would be a new element in that dictionary. This would not be relating entanglement per se, this would be relating complexity, which is a different notion from entanglement, and in particular, unlike entanglement, can grow to be exponentially large. Now, in order to answer your second question, so you said that there were sort of two parts. It was one, what is the story about renormalization? And two, do I have any ideas for where the other space-time dimensions can come from?
Yeah, the question is, where the Ruth Taganaki idea,
yep.
the holographic renormalization group idea, all these I agree, there's something very interesting happening. But they typically tell you how to add one dimension. You have a CFT on D spatial dimension.
Right.
And you get a gravitational theory on D plus one spatial direction.
Right.
It's with the time direction. Is there any idea about how to generate more than one?
Yeah, there may be some ideas. I am not aware of them. So yeah, typically this would, as you say, this relates D and D plus one dimensions. Maybe you're asking, can you then repeat the trick and like say that the D-dimensional theory is really a D minus one dimensional theory and then and sort of ladder on down to no dimensions? There have been a number of speculations in that direction, but no one has been able to make it precise as far as I know.
So this idea of, complexity being the same as action, so if you start at zero time, then are you saying there's zero complexity?
Right, so good. So I have been defining complexity as a relative notion of complexity between two states.
Right.
Nevertheless, I've written complexity, equals space-time here, but earlier complexity more precisely equals action.
Right, so I want to understand that thing.
And so there are all the pieces of evidence I just presented are pieces of evidence to do with the time evolution of the complexity as you evolve in time.
Okay.
So from that point of view, it's fine to treat the, you can just imagine that you pick some reference state, let's say the thermofill double state, and you're always measuring the complexity relative to that initial state. Nevertheless, action isn't a quantity that is merely defined through its time derivative. It is actually, you know, has some zero energy at time equals, you know, zero point action at time equals zero. So you could imagine, you could ask, what does that mean? And there have been a, right. And so, I think that actually that quantity, depending on how you define it, can turn out to be a divergent quantity, a quantity with a well-defined first derivative, but with a UV divergence in it. And the idea is that that quantity, that in fact, this is telling you how to build this entire thermofill doubles. That zero-point action tells you how to build the entire thermofill double state, starting in some simpler state yet, perhaps a product state of all of the qubits.
But just so that I understand,
this is sometimes called the complexity of formation.
So the change in complexity is the change in action. That's what you...
Correct.
Okay,
so complexity equals action, and all of the pieces of evidence I just presented you with were not showing that directly, but showing that the rate of change of complexity and the rate of change of action could be related to each other. Nevertheless, there are a whole bunch longer story that I haven't told you about the complexity of formation, about the actual zero point of the...
So I guess I'm just thinking that maybe this is the statement about the path integral, because basically path integral tells you, relates the action between, I guess, two classical states to the propagator, right? So the exponential of the I times action is a propagator. And basically you're saying that action would change by pi or something like that, and that's saying propagator could have change phase of basically pi, something like that, yeah.
So a sort of intriguing thing about the formula that I wrote down is that if you write e to the I action over h bar, I told you that when this increased by pi, the complexity went from 1 to minus 1, which is, of course, also true of that quantity there. In these holographic theories, it only really makes sense to talk about the action of the bulk. Talking about the action of the boundary doesn't make sense. The reason it doesn't make sense is that the boundaries are highly quantum systems that are the superposition of a whole bunch of different bunch of different branches, all of which have different action. So this is in particular the action of the bulk theory, not the boundary theory. But
you can say this is the propagator of this either.
Well, you could certainly, I mean, here's something that you know to be true, is that the partition function as the sum over quantities that looks like that has to be equal on either side of the conjecture. Yeah.
So what's going to happen to all this in asymptotically flat and De Sitter spaces? Because they both have wormholes. They have black holes. They have wormholes. The wormholes will grow, but there's no conjectured correspondence. Well, there sort of is for De Sitter, but really it's nowhere near what it is in ADS.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, that's a sort of, that's above my pay scale in the sense that the problem of extending holography from negatively curved spaces to asymptotically flat or even harder, asymptotically positively curved, or sitter spaces is an open one. And so this holographic framework you would hope would survive under those circumstances too, but until we know how to describe holography in the sitter space, then I wouldn't exactly know what to say. I might be able to speculate, but I wouldn't know what to say.
This is a very interesting idea, but my question is, this anti-sitter space-time is not a wormhole. So why you didn't use a wormhole solution? For example, you can use a quantum state inside the metric functions, something like that, if there is, and study these things. Because, and what happens when R goes to the infinity? And there is a, what happened to the cosmic horizon, for example?
So first thing, I didn't exactly understand your question. Let me give it a go, and then you can tell me whether I...
Okay. Simply, why didn't you use wormhole solution instead of using this anti-sitter space-time? Because this is not a wormhole solution. This is...
Yeah, so the solution I wrote down, I mean, the solution that we studied wasn't pure anti-sitter space. Pure anti-sitter space, as you say, does not have a wormhole. It's just like pure Minkowski space does not have a wormhole. In order to get the wormhole, you have to put a black hole into these spaces. The same would be true both in Minkowski space and in ADS space. So though I looked at this solution, the solution that's not just pure ADS space, but has this black hole, and then you do have, so a black hole that's sitting in ADS does have a wormhole in this sense. It's not a traversable wormhole. You can't use it to go to Alpha Centauri, but it's a, if you can travel faster than the speed of light, you could traverse this wormhole in those circumstances.
Good question. you define your notion of complexity as a relative measure to some reference state. But on the other side of the duality, you have this notion of the length of the wormhole. And if I understood correctly, that's something that's bounded below. So for a certain family of pairs of points, I get the minimum, and all the others, I get something larger. So you would expect, therefore, to have something which, if you have an association with states, achieves a minimal complexity at some state, and for everything else, it's larger. So it seems to me your reference trace is not arbitrary. You have to say the minimum complexity does occur for this.
That's right.
Purification of the thermal state.
So the minimum complexity is, as you say, is the thermophile double state. Is that state where it was in the middle. The minimal complexity, but that's the minimal amongst some set. And the set is the states that you can just generate just by time evolving on the left or the right. So it certainly can't be...
Make it the minimum by definition. I'd like to see
right.
An argument for why one ought to make it, with some argument that it is the minimum, and not just because you've chosen that as your reference point. Is there some argument like that? So if I've chosen some other state, and I say I'm going to measure complexity relative to this, then it becomes the minimum, and your thermal field double state becomes non-minimal relative to that measure.
Right. So it's certainly the case that if we're going to pick any state in this set, it had better be the thermophile double state, otherwise it's just not going to work at all for that reason. That this sort of simplest t equals zero state before you've done an additional time evolution on top had better be the reference state, otherwise you're going to get a wrong hierarchy about which is more complex than the other. We actually would most prefer, however, if you calculate the complexity of that, even of the thermophile double state, it's UV divergent. The rate of change is not UV divergent, but the complexity itself, depending on what the dimensionality is, can be UV divergent. And that's because the idea is that to build even the thermophile double state takes, and to do it at arbitrary accuracy in the UV, takes a UV divergent number of gates to make it out of some unentangled state between the two sides.
But I thought you had defined the complexity as how many gates do I need starting from the thermal?
Starting with some reference state. So given that all of the pieces of evidence I just presented were evidences to do with the rate of change of complexity, it suffices under those circumstances to just take your reference state to be the thermophile double state. If what you actually want to do is understand the what's called the complexity of formation, the complexity even at t equals zero, there you need to understand it in terms of you're starting with just some product state that isn't even entangled between the two sides, and you're trying to find some circuit that just builds that entirely.
You get an absolute measure of complexity by taking your reference state to be a product state. Seems to me that.
I would say that those words are what we believe to be true, but it's not been proved to be true.
Other questions?
So you presented various pieces of evidence for this conjecture. So the fact that they behave the same, and then if you prod them, they respond the same. But what would it take to prove that they were the same thing? What would that?
Yeah, that is... the gap between what we find good evidence for and that which we can prove is ginormous in this field. That's not just true of complexity equals action. That's true of the entirety of holography is not proved. You know, it's a conjecture. So in terms of what it would mean to prove it, that would be just an incredible, in the general case, would be posthumously sort of beyond my capability. However, what has happened for the rest of holography? Why do people believe it and devote their careers to it, even though there is no mathematical proof that it's true? Well, it's really a collection of, it starts off as a sort of collection of anecdotes that, this works out, you calculate this thing here, and it works out over here, and those are equal to each other. And then those are augmented by some sort of unifying principles that you see that actually this, there's a reason that all of these things are working out in terms of some deeper understanding of physics. So I don't think this is going to be proved anytime soon. What I would aspire for is that we get more and more pieces of evidence that you calculate one thing on one side and it's equal to the thing that it's meant to be on the other side. And that gives you increasing confidence that this is true. You could also imagine another set of evidence is coming with sort of toy models in which you don't do the full ADS-CFT, but you do some sort of version in which you make it using some ansatz with some smaller number of qubits. And then it sort of looks a bit like it, and then you could see how it would emerge in those cases.
Is it possible to state this conjecture a little more precisely? So there are a lot of questions on the meaning of complexity. What about the meaning of action? So is the following the idea? You take an arbitrary cross-section of the boundary. You take the region of the bulk that's space like two of them, and you compute the action of that, including all the boundary terms and corner terms and so on.
Correct.
Is that what is meant by?
Yes.
This is assumed to be true in any asymptotically ADS space-time.
Any holographic space-time. That the conjecture is that is true in any holographic space-time.
Does that mean if you computed the gradient of your complexity, it should be proportional to a momentum?
The gradient with respect to what variable?
A radial derivative. I'm just trying to.
Right. I am not sure. So the. You do not get a complexity density here. You just get a complexity. In the same way that you don't get an action density, you just get an action. And that you can shift things around between boundary terms and bulk terms in the gravitational action. So I'm not sure how to take the derivative that you specify in a way that respects that freedom.
I was
freedom.
Thinking that the total action could play the role of a Hamilton-Jacobi function.
Right.
And it depends on some degrees of freedom on the other boundary. And then if you took the gradient with respect to those degrees of freedom,
I see.
You would generate.
In that case, that should work. The only concern would be that this is not a regular, you're not taking the action between two time slices, as you might naturally do. You're taking, or at least not between two sort of zeroic. The construction is that you consider a region that looks like this, that you send in a light ray out in both directions, and you're considering the action of this region intersecting with something over here. So it's not I did spend some time trying to derive this principle from Hamilton and Jacobi, to derive some of the results more smoothly from just the bulk results from a Hamilton-Jacobi framework. I was not able to do that. But if you have ideas, I'd be delighted to hear them.
Okay, well, before we thank Adam one more time, let me just remind you we have snacks in the bistro downstairs, so if you have more questions, you can go ahead and Adam. Okay, let's...